miss you when I
back, everyone. For today, I'm actually joined with my friend Rob, who we're going to discuss Frank Truman. But before we get too much further, I'll just hand him the mic so he can introduce himself further.
Thanks, Colin. I'm just a fan, really. If you ask me if I'm plugging any kind of a podcast or a blog, I don't have anything for you. Just here to have a great conversation about our favorite show. Specifically, thanks for asking me to talk about Frank Truman with you. I think that there's a lot to cover.
Oh, I absolutely agree. To start off, normally I would start off with something, their earliest origins or, something like pertaining to secret history. But I feel like with Frank Truman, it's a little bit different because the reason why we got Frank Truman is a little unexpected, because I think a lot of the listeners know that because Michael Ankin wasn't able to return, this is why they brought Robert Forster in. Was that ever a barrier that you had with the return in terms of Frank Truman's presence? Did you ever just feel like, oh, I wish it was Harry? Or did you feel like Frank just worked independently of himself from the very start?
Robert Forster was always a welcome sight in anything that I would watch. It was a real pleasure to see him show up in The Return and become part of Twin Peaks. I think he fits very well. I like that he's Harry's brother. I do think they could have done something to get Michael Ankin back. I was disappointed. I have wondered if that's by design that they left Harry out of it. I think that Robert Forster brings a maturity and wisdom to not just to the sheriff's station, but also to our experience. Yeah, he's absolutely welcome sight, and I think that he really added a lot to the show.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I guess for people that might not know, is that Robert Forster, he was actually supposed to be Harry Truman in the pilot, but what happened is, between, I think, landing the role of Sheriff Truman and then also working another project, the schedule started to conflict. And I believe Robert Forster called David Lynch directly saying that, oh, you know, it's this new guy. He's an independent filmmaker. I can't stand this guy up. For someone like Robert Forster to turn down working on Twin Peaks because he wanted to have faith in, you know, this rising talent, I think that says a lot about Robert Forster, and also I think why he fits in well into being Frank Truman, sort of that selflessness that you see in the character of Frank Truman. And I guess it's also probably worth addressing is that Robert Forster was also in Mulholland Drive when it was the pilot. And you can just tell by the way that those detectives were set up that they were probably going to be a more prominent part had it been picked up by ABC. So I think that Robert Forster, like you said, he's always a welcome face. He's always one of the best parts, if not the best part of any movie or show I see him in. And there's that part of me where sometimes I think to myself, oh, I wish it was Harry Truman. Because there's times like when you watch The Return, they'll mention Truman and then they'll have to reiterate saying both Trumans. I was like, it does admittedly feel like it was written in, but what were they going to do? Not bring it up. So I love Robert Forster in this role. And I think he's the only person that could have feasibly filled in the boots for Michael Ankin for me.
I think we have to remember, too, that they're different people. And so Michael Ankin brought, at the time, a more of a wily kind of a persona. He certainly was an authoritarian, and he was great to work with, and he kept an open mind. But Robert Forster, like I said, he just brings a maturity, and this conveys the sense that he's somebody who's been through a lot, and he was probably the right Truman for this time. So, you know, yeah, they had to acknowledge that Harry was a very important part of Twin Peaks. And it's a little hokey, you know, when he's on the phone and we're getting just this little bit of service towards Harry when he's like, Harry, beat this thing. It's, referring to his illness that we really don't get any information on in the show. But clearly, Frank is there to be the father figure to the police station, and he fills that fatherly role that probably we're not getting because Major Briggs isn't there. And, you know, really all the father figures are gone, but there's this grieving father, Frank Truman, who is there to have this experience with us.
We'll get to more so about the grieving father aspect once we arrive at their turn, but I think one of the things to ease into the secret history, what you're mentioning is that Frank and Harry are definitely indeed different people. Because at least on the show, I look at Harry where he's the type of person where he has that friendly face, but you know that like he can change that on a dime if he has to. Frank Truman has that very tough as nails demeanor where it's like the world of Twin Peaks is a lot different by the time we get to the return. Crime is more rampant. It's not just behind closed doors anymore. For someone like Frank to be at that helm, to basically hold down the fort with a much larger crew at the sheriff's station, the crime being more rampant. Like we were mentioning, Harry's illness, and there's a lot more of a balancing act for him. And I think Robert Forster and the character Frank were just like the right fit for this type of world.
And I think we have to keep in mind that 30 years have passed. And so maybe Frank 30 years ago was, we have to assume, was not as mature as he is now. So it might be a little unfair to compare Frank of 2017 with Harry of 1990 because a lot has happened since then. But yeah, Harry, much like, I forget the word that you just used, but yeah, he was probably more playful and more volatile too, as we saw. And I'm not going to do it, but when he says, get out of here, when he's drunk, I think one of the scenes, not to go off on a Harry tangent, but just one of the scenes that people tend to laugh at when he's drunk and he's grieving over Josie. But you can't picture Robert Forster doing that. You know, he'd be more in control. He'd be the rock that people turned to during times of trouble. But I'm sure he did suffer when he lost his son, and probably has been through lots of tough times in his life. And I think that's why he has the perspective that he does. Just keeps an open mind in all the crazy stuff that's going on around him. He's got a lot of eccentric people around him, but he's a kind of a regular guy, if you will. And there's a lot going on underneath the surface, but he keeps a very mild manner.
I think the reason why I have this almost contrasting view of Harry and Frank is that I actually listened to the Secret History audiobook like in two sittings throughout last weekend, at least time this recording. And you can even see just the little differences of Harry and Frank, where it's around 1968. I should probably mention this is when Frank is the team captain of the Twin Peaks High Lumberjacks. And the news article, it's about when Hank drops the ball. And it's about like how Frank like when he's asked about it in the paper, he's like, oh, we were this close. So you can kind of get that sense of just how truly disappointed he was. But later on that night, Frank and Ed Hurley, they actually shortly after this game, they had to pull Harry away from Hank because they thought he was gonna beat him senselessly. And I think there's just something about like the way Frank would have handled that situation versus Harry, because neither Frank nor Harry, they didn't tell their father, who was the sheriff at the time, about Hank's betrayal. And this is where we get into the muddy waters of the secret history. And then when Hank was quote unquote working with Renault, I know that was a bit of an information dump. And even though this might not be explicitly about Hank, do you have any thoughts about the whole Hank betraying and or him quote unquote work with Jacques, even though that doesn't seem to align with the original series?
Well, what we get from the secret history is probably unreliable information, as has been said on your program previously. Just, you got to note how you said it was the Lumberjacks won the show. They were the Steeplejacks. So that's a probably an intentional bit of misinformation. I think also Frank is a new character as of 2017. We first meet him in this book. We were never aware of him before. I don't want to call him a retcon because he's such a good character. However, introducing him and portraying him in those limited instances, like with Hank and Harry almost killing each other, is designed to plant that seed, as I think it did with you, Colin, that he's the voice of reason. He's the cooler head. So I think your question was about Hank and if I have thoughts on his relationship to what, the Trumans?
The Renault family. More so because they talk about how in that article where basically the conclusion that they come to, and once again, I'm with you on the whole, this feels like it's some sort of false information. How so? It changes for me over time. But I think the most important part is just like the fact that they kept it with the Bookhouse Boys and they never brought it to their father. Yeah, there's just something about like the Bookhouse Boys and the type of person Frank was at that time that I find really fascinating.
Apparently, the Renaults have been a problem for a long time, and as we saw in The Return, they're not going anywhere. As which Jean-Michel Renault was making very clear. So I think Hank and his lineage indicated that he was very suggestible and would easily be tempted by a life of crime, and so you have this dichotomy set up between Hank Jennings and then the Trumans, where you have bad decision makers with against guardians. The Trumans are true men who are aware of the evil going around them, and they lead other people in the community so that they can fight this evil.
And I know that this is more so for the Access Guide, but because we're focused on their perspective of justice and how they handle it through the Bookhouse Boys, was there anything from the Access Guide relating to the Bookhouse Boys that stands out to you? Because when I think of the Bookhouse Boys, I think of the Passion Play, and to me that was just like such a radical change of what I thought about the Bookhouse Boys. Because in season one, Cooper refers to it as a secret society, but in the Access Guide, it comes off as something that Frost was writing down, because I feel like just like the type of things that he gravitates to, the way that the Passion Play is described, where it's like very ritualistic, it happens like at set times per year, and just the way that's handled.
Nobody knows when it's going to happen, but they know that it will happen at some point. No, I think that it's easy to picture people like Big Ed and Harry and even James doing these things, and probably other guys that we don't know about, because it's more like a fraternity, probably. So they have a lot of pride in their town and in their brotherhood. And so they probably take it seriously, but there's probably a bit of a tongue-in-cheek aspect to it as well. Passion play, that is.
I think there's just something about Frank where it's like kind of where he's at, where it's like if there's anyone who knows about like the Passion Play, or I guess the more, when I say occultic, I don't mean like evil, I just mean more of a hidden knowledge aspect to it. But I feel like Frank, certainly by the late 60s, he would be very well aware of it, and that maybe there'd be a passing of the torch. And I know that obviously he wasn't written at the time of the Access Guide, but when I think of him, the Bookhouse Boys, I just have to think of like how much did he know, or how much did he take part in?
All of it. He knew all of it. He probably was a big factor in keeping things going.
Absolutely. With that in mind, with the Bookhouse Boys, that it wasn't just like how they served justice in Twin Peaks, but it was around this time, because it's the late 60s, that the Vietnam War was taken off. Frank, he was a Green Beret during the Vietnam War. Like, it's th this is. I believe this is in the Hawk when he talks about the Battle of Big Ed and Norman Nadine. But Frank is brought up about that for the Vietnam War. And I think also he does actually talk about how sometime, I think when they were in high school, that he gave Hawk his name, which Hawk apparently hated. But I should mention that for the Battle of Big Ed and Norman Nadine, out of all the documents in the secret history, this is the one that's just like fried my mind out of like the weird characterization. Again, I think if there's one where we're going off of false information, I have theories. Like I actually when I was listening to the audiobook, I was actually thinking about Hawk, where I'm half convinced that they, after a big success at the Bookhouse, and some that they solved, that Hawk just got like blackout drunk, and like he just wrote this thing as for fun about Ed and Norman Nadine. Made no sense, somehow typed it out to perfection, and then they just left it there as a trophy. I know that's steering away from Frank Truman,
Funny
but
to think
just,
about.
yeah, it's I just remember, I was like, why
I
would
think he
this?
loves them too. I think he loves Ed. And I think there's also that camaraderie aspect that I was alluding to, where all these Bookhouse boys have just great love for each other, and also they like to rib each other.
I don't know if I have much else about his time during the Vietnam War. But when he does return, he does actually have, and we're going by the final dossier at this point, a very prestigious career in law enforcement, They say Western Washington. I always kind of figured that if it's not Seattle, it's a neighboring town or neighboring city around Seattle. Was there anything you had in mind, whether it's about his time in law enforcement before Twin Peaks, or even if we if you want to go back from some for the Vietnam War?
A lot is left to the imagination on that, but his time in Vietnam is probably a big piece of the personal pain that he experienced in his life. So I think that's intentional that that's included. He's sturdy, he's capable, very grounded, and I think because he has all that perspective, he's the right person to be leading the sheriff's department, especially as things are getting worse with, increase in illegal drug use and trafficking. I'd really have to imagine that he is a great asset no matter where he is. I don't know why he would leave Twin Peaks, though.
I don't know why offhand, but I think one thing that's worth mentioning about why he would return at least was that in the final dossier, they talk about how he took over Harry's position after what I put in quotes a cancer diagnosis. It should be mentioned that he was the only one that knows about Harry's illness, but Hawk actually picked up on it instantly. I don't think he ever explicitly talked about it with Frank, but the big thing that came out of this was that Frank Truman agreed to work for 2 years at the Twin Peaks Sheriff Station. And then once he would finish, he would hand the title off to the title of sheriff to Hawk.
That sounds about right. That's how it should go.
And I guess the one thing I should mention is that in the final dossier, they do refer to Harry's illness explicitly as cancer. But I can't help but think that in the return, that when he does call Harry, he never explicitly says cancer. He always says, beat this thing. When I think of stuff like, the sickness that we see in the return, I think of like the sickness that we see, not in just like Twin Peaks, but in David Lynch's filmography, even his painting, The Six Men Getting Sick, is that sickness was always like this kind of ambiguous thing where it's just there's something about this unexplained illness that Lynch gravitates to. Do you think that it is actually cancer as Mark Frost wrote it, or do you think that there's something more ambiguous at work?
I think cancer is a safe assumption, and I think that the Mark Frost books are relying on a lot of assumptions. So it's really hard to confirm that, and that could be a reason why David Lynch says, "Hey, that's Mark's deal, these books," because he probably intentionally did not name the illness in any of the 18 parts. And Harry was referred to a lot, and Frank was in it a lot.
In terms of having something that's like a medical illness that we see in the return, and this is why I kind of lean towards the Lynchian aspect, is that I'm thinking of Ashley Judd's character, Beverly Page, when she goes home to her husband. And she's like, it's this very, I don't want to just use bizarre arbitrarily, but there is something about that setup that it's like, it doesn't look like a real life setup of like keeping someone on life support in any way. That I kind of take it as that there's some sort of sickness that's permeating Twin Peaks. It defies medical explanation.
Isn't that anecdotal though? I mean, you're taking one case, Tom Page, and then Harry, who may be suffering from something like that. I don't know if we're meant to infer that. There are also a lot of people that are still with us from 30 years ago, 25 years ago, that are not afflicted. So I just think we have to be very careful with making assumptions just because one person has an illness that the other person who is apparently ill also has the same illness.
Oh, that's fair enough. I think also I just think of there's a scene when Bobby, when he's trying to quell the chaos after the bullet goes to the Double R Diner. That's like when the it's like the child who just emerges and they're just like there's just some bile dripping from
That
like
was
her
something
mouth.
else.
Yeah, it's
Harry is not at home doing that, Colin.
I would hope not. But no, I think there's just something about the way sickness is displayed in the town of Twin Peaks that always just kind of made me think, oh, what's this about? And does this allude to anything?
Lynch would not do that to Harry.
I would hope not. But no, I think you're right. There is something about how I shouldn't just go off of like what Tom Page is doing. It's just that there's something about the way sickness was portrayed on screen and the fact that Harry's off screen that makes me think like, what could it be?
I do think that, as other folks have said, and certainly on your program, that there is an illness that has pervaded this community, and each person is suffering in a different way.
I think you're totally onto something with that. Like I said, I never like to think that like the way I look at it is like a definitive way. Yeah, it's always I was sometimes these are almost like shower thoughts of like, oh, like what would this mean? And am I looking too far into it?
That's part of the fun of it. We're never going to have you're going to be doing this podcast for the rest of your life because you could keep having conversations about different aspects. I should have added when I introduced myself that I've been watching Twin Peaks since 1991, and it was really friends who gave me their copies of their video cassettes. I really got into it once it ended. I had caught snippets when it was just on regular TV, and I'm saying all this now to say that all these years later, I find more things that are just embedded that either were in plain sight or just that came to me after kind of baking in my mind all these years. And I don't think we can ever have enough good conversation about it.
Yeah, of course. All that I mentioned that for the final dossier, that's a pretty good lead-in for the return. And I think the first thing we should mention is that this would have been presumably sometime after the Vietnam War, where Frank he would marry Doris, and then they would have one son who's not named, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I even looked up the Twin Peaks wiki. I couldn't find a name for him, but their marriage like fell apart before the events of the return because he ended his life after a I guess tumultuous, like, tumultuous,
Post-traumatic stress. It
yeah,
was
post-traumatic
awesome.
stress because of serving in the military. I know that there's a lot left to our imaginations, but did you ever think about the relationship of Doris that he had before, during, and after, or like anything about his son in general?
I think their relationship is as, I can't remember the switchboard operator's name at the moment, but she was a good character when she said it wasn't always like that. So I think we get that answer there. But Doris was one of the unexpected, interesting new characters who shows up briefly but makes a memorable mark. She had very grand gestures and accentuated emphases on certain words, and she stares at him like, "What the heck is wrong with you? Because you're not dealing with this mold, Frank." When the twins got into the cupboard again, and he's coming over, and it's just this string of problems that she's unloading on him, but he receives her so empathetically because he loves her and because they've shared this loss together. I think we are told by Chad that their son had served in the Middle East. That's the impression I get. Probably is an included commentary on the effects of war. And so now you have a father who is in the Vietnam War, and you have the son who is perhaps in Iraq or Afghanistan, probably something like that. And so with PTS, you have another form of suffering, and it's not the only person who dies by suicide that either happens on screen or is alluded to in this season. So I think this particular exchange about their son and then meeting Doris, and you're thinking, oh, poor Frank, like that he has this awful person to put up with that he's stuck with. But then it's framed for us differently that Frank is a father and he's a loving person. And so he understands that her anger isn't about him. So I just really appreciate what they do for Robert Forster, and that he was not just brought in to replace Harry. That's not what happened here. He's there to be the sheriff and the father figure that we all need in this season of the Twin Peaks.
When I think of Margaret, I believe it's in when she tells Hawk that Laura is the one. She also says that the Truman brothers are both true men. I actually think of his interactions with Doris as being like one of the strong points for that regard, because it's sort of like I was saying earlier, is that there's something about the way Frank Truman can hold down the fort, because there's all the responsibilities he has as a sheriff. There's talking to Harry and trying to keep up with him. And in the case of Doris, he always has good solutions where it's like, hey, oh, do you have a bigger bucket? And he deals with that as best as he possibly can. Or then like it's like, oh, what time is it? Well, I think they're a little busy. They'll call in a few minutes. And like he always just like he's always very calm. Like it's like he never get a sense he's ever gonna really lose his cool. And like he does everything on his end that he possibly can. Or even like when she talks about her father about like the car problems, it's like, oh, did he put it in reverse? I forgot how he says it exactly, but he always consciously
He's
thinks
so
these
patient.
things, and he always seems to be on top of it. There's never like a lapse in judgment. There's never like an error on his part. He just does everything to be supporting and loving for her. And I think the fact that their relationship is not what it was before their son ended his life, I think there's something to be said about how he handles himself and how he can deal with these situations.
Absolutely. And the fact that we see them walking out together too, with his arm around her, she knows that she still needs him. And he is a patient person because of the circumstances. And people are not going to be the same way all the time. Doris is not the same younger woman that he married. And, he has to be strong for her. So I would also assume what we know about him that he's doing the best that he can and that he probably is trying to help her as much as he can. And I want to add too that it's Maggie. Maggie was the switchboard operator, and she was played by Jodie Thielen. And she was on the schedule to come to the 2019 Twin Peaks Fest, which I attended. And I was very excited that she was part of that lineup, but she couldn't make it. I think that's where she was going to be. Hopefully, I'm getting that right. But she went to something that I went. She was scheduled to go to something that I went to, and she couldn't make it for some reason. But I thought she was a good character as well.
No, same here. There's something about, like, even though she's really confined to one spot for every all of her scenes, she just has like that certain sternness of like you need to be for a dispatch officer, and like how she can handle Chad, like in a probably the most tasteless part, like maybe not the worst thing Chad's ever done, but definitely the worst thing he did in front of her. But I guess to move on, I think this is actually getting to the actual scenes of the return. The very first scene that we see of Frank, it's when like he goes into the sheriff's station, and Lucy, she's not sure how wireless phones work, so he just comes in, just shows the phone, and she flies back screaming. Andy's like, he's like, you know, she doesn't like those phones. Like, well, I'm sorry, Andy. I couldn't stay in the parking lot all night. Where again, like for me, I kind of look at those subtle differences of like what would Harry be like in this situation. Where I think Frank, like he wants to be nice about it, but he also wants to be realistic.
Harry would have handled it the same way. They have work to do, and by this point, it is absolutely absurd that Lucy doesn't understand how phones work. But as much as Andy would like for Frank, because he loves Lucy so much, to be able to just stay in the parking lot and not upset Lucy, it's just not tenable. We have been dealing with Lucy and her phone issues since the pilot. This is just a very odd progression of that. I was a little concerned when I first saw that scene because I thought this is very, very absurd. And obviously, she's not just flying back, but like, they pulled her back. The more I watch it, the more I laugh because I just had to wrap my loving arms around the whole show. But that was one thing that I thought, oh no, this is just so stupid that she doesn't understand how cell phones work. But Frank is very patient, and he's been dealing with all these folks for a long time, so he's not really getting too hung up on it either.
Actually, on the topic of patience, and this actually does tie into Lucy and Andy as well, I think that even though he's not the focal point of the scene I'm coming up, I have to bring up the fact that he's the one that has to answer to Wally Brando when he shows up like a couple parts later.
I'm glad you're bringing this up.
Because I'm one of those people where when I think of Wally Brando, I was like, God, what is this? Like, I think I said in my James episode where I said that for all the ways that people talk about James and how much they don't really like the Rebel Without a Cause type of archetype with him, I think for all the hate that James gets, Wally Brando deserves. And I just think of like how it's supposed to be freezing cold out there, or at least I think Harry Goas, I think he said that it was freezing cold when they filmed that scene that night. And I'm just thinking of just the fact that Wally Brando, he's just going off on these like kind of pretentious diatribes, like my dharma is my road, and I just love how at the end Frank, he just has this moment of pause, like, well, Wally.
May the road rise up to meet your wheels. I think that's what he says.
I'm pretty sure you're right. I think you got
Your
word for
listeners will
word.
correct me if I got it wrong. But I'm really glad you mentioned Wally because it's another surprising scene with another surprising character that when they appear and they just start talking, kind of like with Doris, you're like, I've never seen anything like this. And I don't know when it's going to end, one, and two, I don't know how this can possibly end and why is this happening? But I thought it was really funny. And Robert Forster as a straight man was perfection. I have my concerns with Wally as a character because I don't know if he's real because of that picture that Lucy has on her desk, where clearly it was pasted together. And I heard or read a theory a while back that Wally isn't really their son, and that because they actually lost the baby or something, they hired this guy to act pretend that he's their son, so that Lucy wouldn't lose her mind, really, I guess. And I think that's a really fun theory. I think that you're right, that it is a very pretentious speech, and it takes the fact that Frank is a very busy person not into account at all. And he's just saying his personal, I don't even know, the bullshit, I guess. So, Wally was a lot of fun though, and I loved, just how Frank, you can clearly see that he was exercising restraint. But what do you think, Colin, about Wally Brando? Is he What's the deal with that picture on the desk?
If we're going with the picture itself, I would say it was Lynch having fun with Photoshop. But no, in all seriousness, I think that I last year around Christmas time, I posted that picture on Instagram. I posted something effective, I hope your Christmas is not as cursed as the Brennan family Christmas photo. I just remember I never noticed the like I never really focused on that framed photo until probably my fourth rewatch. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like what is Wally Brando? I don't know if I've ever really, if the whole he's the replacement son, I don't know if I could ever fully subscribe to that, but it's hard to overlook just how cursed that photo is because of Wally Brando. There's somewhere it just seems so alien-like.
But that photo didn't happen. It's not even a photo, Colin. It's a composite. All their faces are distorted and just paste in there in the most primitive form of Photoshop that they could have used. So it's not even a photo.
But at least with Harry Goes and Kimmy Robertson, it's like, well, this is kind of what I expect them to look like by the mid-90s. It's just like I think the Michael Cera, like this like creepy photo, I think that just it's so hard to not unsee that like it just I just kind of accept everything else as normal but that one part.
That Andy and Lucy, their faces were pasted in that too.
Oh yeah, they were. It's I think it was just the fact that just how weird Wally Brando looked, where it's just I was just hyper focused on like on that once I spotted it.
Well, speaking of which, since we're still on this, I know you're probably going to move on soon, but I'm glad that we're still on it. Just as Wally is delivering his monologue, and he just pauses to look up very seriously at Frank. What do you think's happening there? Is he looking for a reaction?
I think he wants some bizarre validation. Like I think he thinks he's like a lot cooler than he really is. Yeah, I know I'm projecting my dislike on Wally Brando, but I think it's like he knows that this is kind of a pose. He knows that this is just like an image sort of thing. And I think that he does want approval from Frank, but I think it's just that he's just such like a pompous little weirdo.
He insults him too, and he says, that he has gone and seen the world from, I forget the town in California he mentions, but then to Alexandria, Virginia, which is right next door to where I live. So I like that part of it. But anyway, he's very condescending. But nevertheless, he was a welcome character to me because of how bizarre the whole thing was. But just you needed Frank there to bringing it back to Frank and Robert Forster. He brought that groundedness.
But actually, this is where we're going to dive into the more esoteric aspects. From part one, Hawk is basically almost under the instructions of Margaret to just try to figure out all the stuff at the sheriff station. And the scene that I have written down with Frank is that Hawk, he does go through the remnants of Laura Palmer's diary pages. And they're talking about like, how Hawk found it in the bathroom stall. He talks about how he thinks that Leland hid it before they thought they'd frisk him. But did you ever have any thoughts about like what Frank, like the questions he was asking to Hawk, or basically how these pages got into the sheriff's station?
Frank trusts Hawk. That's clear. They have a lot of interactions. And so, whatever Hawk's telling him, he's going to accept. So, when Hawk is telling him that it was probably Leland who left those pages inside of the men's room stall door, then I think Frank is going to go along with that. But, like everyone said in the first season, everybody knew who Laura Palmer was. They knew her on some level, and I'm gonna assume that Frank knew her too, and he may have let a lot of that memory go because it's a very hard situation, especially as a grieving father, just to think about what it's like to lose, a teenage daughter like that. Certainly, Mrs. Palmer is still in town. So he knows, he's familiar with the situation, but his first reaction upon hearing it was like, oh, yeah, I seem to kind of remember that. And I wonder if because, and this is just my own theory, but I'm wondering if he is kind of detached from it because of his own loss of a child.
That's a great point. Yeah, I never would have thought that connection of like Laura being gone, and also with him, his son being deceased as well, about that connection. The main thing that I wrote down is that I actually thought that these pages were more indicative of like an alternate reality, because in season two, Harold, like after that betrayal he gets from Donna and Maddie, when they go and they find his dead body, like all the pages are completely ripped up. And it took me way too long to figure this out, because I always thought that maybe somehow there were some extra pages that they found after the scene. But I'm thinking of like in season two, is that Cooper, he just has these pages like in puzzle piece together to try to get any semblance of information. But I think that if those pages are in like such pristine condition, that's got to mean something, because as we know in the final dossier, there's two realities, the one where Laura's killed, the one where she goes missing. I think this has to be a reality of like where I don't know what Her where Harold would be at this point, but I would imagine this reality did entail Donna and Maddie going to his house and him having the secret diary. Yeah, I think there's just something about like how those pages are so well preserved that I have a hang-up about. And it's something that Frank and Hawk, they don't really seem to address it. They just kind of accept it as is.
It is significant that the pages are found and also that they didn't produce all of them, that there's still one page missing, which Lynch has commented since he finished the season. So there's still some mystery that remains.
One of the things that I find interesting, I know that people had discourse about this since Fire Walk With Me, because one of the pages, it's when Laura writes in her diary that the Good Dale is in the lodge and he can't get out. I think what makes it so interesting is that it's from the secret diary, but she handed it off to Harold. I know this is more of a Fire Walk With Me question, but did you ever think that?
She had already handed it off to Harold by that point.
Yeah, because she gives it to him earlier in the movie and she has a dream about halfway into it.
Yeah, this is where our imaginations really have to take a leap, because it's possible she kept writing while she was having her last week, because that's the time that she would have had to do it. And it does make sense that Leland could have found that because he was spying on her and reading her diary for years. She would have had to do it that week, then and there, and it might not have been in Harold's possession ever. I think that she probably wrote it because Annie asked her to, and she probably wrote it down in her other book. You had the not so secret diary,
I guess it's really not that secret, especially when
right?
Cooper could just open it on a whim like that.
And Leland said, you have to open that. And meanwhile, looking back, it's not a grieving father asking that question. It's a guilty person asking that question. You have to open that. You have to take that. Gotta love Ray Wise.
I mentioned one of my previous Laura Palmer episodes, but I view Fire Walk With Me as like it's kind of going through the perspective of Laura and how she views the world. I've gone with the idea that she does return to Harold to write it in that diary, to keep it away from Bob, because that's something that she's really gravitating towards. And I just think that there's something about the way that trauma and memory don't quite go hand in hand with her, just because that's something we see in the real world, unfortunately.
That's why it's a leap of imagination, because we don't see it. We think we're getting all the pertinent information in the movie, but we don't see her going back. So it's just we have to come up with feasible courses of action that maybe she took to write that and leave it somewhere.
I just think there's something about just the fact that it is in one of the pages, explicitly one of the pages that was salvaged, and the fact that Frank and Hawk are going through it was like, well, it has to be in the secret diary, at least the way I look at it. So I just wanted to get your take on it.
That's an interesting question to think about, really. It's one of those mysteries.
But yeah, the next part that I have is that I actually wrote down my notes. It's when Frank's in his office, he's talking to Doc Hayward, And then he pulls out this really snazzy desk where it's like he has like a little lever, the computer comes up, and he talks to Doc Hayward directly. I know that there's quite the information dump from Doc Hayward on his end, but do you have any thoughts about the scene about Frank and like and or even just his desk?
Yeah, that was fun. Well, Frank's a cool guy, obviously. So, of course, he has a cool desk. I get the impression he may be into gadgetry. And remember, he does know how phones work. So, he's going to be a little bit more high tech than Lucy is over in her cubicle. But seriously, I think that he is probably well rounded and he built that desk. He finished it and he added these neat features, and he probably has some places where he stores extra weapons and personal effects. Remember, he had that weapon right there too when he needed it.
The desk is something that's just so subtly just amazing to me because it looks so old-fashioned, but it's also very high-tech as well. It's something that even the realm of like what we see in the Twin Peaks Sheriff Station is pretty unique. Yeah, this is kind of hot off the heels of what we were talking about with the secret diary because at this point, now that they know that there's a quote-unquote good Cooper, this is where he talks to Doc Hayward about all the events we see right after the events of season two. Probably worth mentioning is that from Doc Hayward's perspective, everything he had that night before is that there's the Miss Twin Peaks contest that went awry. There's making sure Donna's safe, and then Ben Horn shows up, and then he cracks his head open, accidentally, I need to put. So Doc Hayward's already dealing with a lot by the time he gets to that hospital. So for him to see Cooper leaving Audrey's room, the way he describes it in what is to us very alarming because what we know about Mr. C and Audrey. But I just thought it was really interesting of like where how Frank was able to what he got from it, that he doesn't quite understand the everything about doppelgangers, but I think he's starting to put the pieces together that there's something a little off about like this quote unquote new Cooper.
Well, both his feet are on the ground for sure, but he does have an open mind. And I think about part 14, where it seems like everything happens in that part. And he calls Gordon Cole and he tells him that he got a message about there being two Coopers. So he understands that there's something to that. He also is planning that walk to the Jack Rabbit's palace in that episode. So he's just taking this leap with Hawk, and just goes back to what you asked me earlier. If Hawk is saying something, there's a certain risk or element of danger that they must heed, then Frank just is going to go with it, even though he might not physically be able to see it with his own eyes just yet.
And actually, the next part that I have written down, it's a bit of a non sequitur, but I'm thinking about the scene with Chad when he's eating in the break room, and there's that part where I just love the dynamic between Chad and Frank, yeah, because like he's reading something, and then like you can tell the way Frank comes in, it's like a this is not the first time they've had this conversation. It's like, well, you're supposed to eat in the break room. He's like, well, you guys do it all the time, and it just sounds like the most pathetic retaliation. Like it's like he doesn't respect his superiors. He doesn't really respect anyone, really. But what I think is so interesting about this scene is the fact that he has two TV dinners. Because the more I think about the return, and especially this year, I think about like how food is used in the return, that there's something about like manufactured or processed food and like what it says about the people. And because like we have that scene later on, actually it's the last scene with Ed and Norma where she talks about how she doesn't want to sacrifice the quality and that she uses real local made cherries. But then like there's processed food that's used quite a bit during the return. In the case of Chad with the two TV dinners, Chantal and Hutch, they eat nothing but junk food. I think it's just one of those little things that's it's not really mentioned explicitly in plain sight. And it's not really about Frank either, but I just felt like I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up this scene with Chad or even just really bring up Chad's relationship with Frank.
That is funny, and you're right. And that is, as soon as you said there was a scene later on, I knew you were going to talk about Norma talking about the fresh ingredients. He gets arrested in part 14 when the rest of them are going to have their lunch with the sandwiches. And I want to talk about that too, because it cracks me up. But a scene in an episode prior to that is when he's all put upon and he trudges out of the room, and they ask him to leave, is what you were referring to. Frank didn't really strike me as being completely fed up with Chad until he arrested him. He definitely kept his cards close to his vest, or chest, I don't know. But anyway, He was annoyed by him, and you could tell that Chad wasn't his favorite person. But I love when in part 14, Bobby had all the sandwiches and he's laying them out and he puts them in a row because, police officers are very dress right dress, as we say in the military, very organized. And he's saying, "We have roast beef and cheese, ham and cheese, turkey and cheese, and just cheese." And I'm going off on a tangent now too, but I gotta say, of course, the just cheese belonged to Andy. And when he's asked who ordered that by Hawk, he's like a little kid, very happily saying, "I did." And then a second later, after the events with Chad happen, and Frank goes, "You did it to yourself, Chad." After he slaps the handcuffs on him and Hawk pulls the gun on him. They come back to the sandwiches after Bobby and Andy lead him out. And then it's just Frank and Hawk again. And Hawk is looking at Frank very respectfully, as they always had been, as whenever we see them together. And he says, "There's your roast beef and cheese." And of course, he's the one who ordered the roast beef, because that would be the sandwich for the strongest man there. And of course, he slides the sandwich package out, picks it up as his hand, probably mulls over for 2 seconds what happened in the last minute, and then with a mark of assurance, he taps that sandwich package with, "Yep, let's go."
We're mentioned that Bobby comes in. I believe he's the one that comes with the food, but I think if it's not this scene, it's shortly after where before this, it's part nine where they go to Betty's house and then Bobby finds out like all this thing, what his father left for him. And they're going through, it's like, what is this that Garland left for us? And then Bobby starts laughing and Frank's like, oh, do you find this amusing? He's like, he just gets it. Like somehow he just, like, he's like, he, it just rings to him. He has that epiphany of like, oh, I get this. So they go outside, they throw it, and they decode it. And of course, it's the Cooper Cooper sign that Briggs showed to Cooper in early season two. And that's when they go to into the woods to Jack Rabbit's palace. And believe it or not, this scene, both before, during, and after the firemen and Andy, this scene I was thinking about for days after my last rewatch. I think there's something about when you see after Andy, before he comes back, you have these like three imposed layers of Frank Truman, Bobby, Hawk, all returning back to Jack Rabbit's palace. And the fact that there were three of them was just something that puzzled me for days. Did you have any thoughts? I know this is a huge, huge scene with part 14, but do you have any thoughts about like how Frank figures into all of this?
What do you mean? Like, you're asking why there were three of them? Three of who? You mean aside from Frank?
Oh no, it's because when it shows them returning to Jack Rabbit's palace, it's like it's layered three times over where they're
Oh,
all
I know
walking in
exactly.
more or
Yes.
less the same three,
That
yeah,
was
the same trajectory.
when Andy is still with the firemen and the other three guys are just kind of wandering. I think it's meant to show perhaps a fugue state, or just that they're kind of having feet in different dimensions at the same time. They're confused. They're not fully going to remember what happened there. And I think that visually, that's meant to show us that there is a fog over their brains while Andy is been temporarily summoned by the firemen. While that swirly thing happens in the sky, they become transfixed by it, and something sinister could be happening too.
The one thing that you did touch upon is that you mentioned how I think it's specifically Frank and Hawk they say to each other, where it's like, how do we get back here? I don't know. What I look at in particular is that why is they were over each one of them was overlaid three times. And I think what I was wrestling with for days was that I felt like it's like each one that you see, it represents three different realities because they all show back up. And I feel like no matter, because when I look at it, I look at it as there's the reality where Laura is killed. There's the one where Laura goes missing. And the third one, this is why I spent so much time thinking about it. But I think it's like how he kind of imposes. It's almost like Cooper's dream, if you will. I'm thinking of like in part 17 when you see his face superimposed over everything, that he has his own reality of sorts. I just think of that scene and like why Frank and Hawk, they're very well tapped and they have a good intuition, but they're not gonna be as honed as Andy in that moment. So I just thought it was really interesting to bring up and where you stood on it.
No, I'd be willing to take that ride with you on that theory. I think it's possible. And one of the reasons why I like listening to your show is that you in particular seem to see, you see things that I hadn't considered. I think that if that were the case for this, that would beg the question of, well, would they all necessarily be together at that time and place? Maybe, given just how pivotal that event is, that no matter what plane they're on or whatever reality they're in, that they would always be coming back here, which would make your theory or just idea about that even cooler. But then, you know, you'd have to go down that through that history of, well, if Laura didn't die, would Bobby become a policeman? Right. So I don't know. It's so unknowable, but so much fun to think about.
Yeah, and it was so amazing because, like, I remember I should mention is that when I watched The Return on my rewatch last year, I watched it as an 18-hour movie, and yeah, I watched it all in one day.
Yeah, you're really hardcore. You're more hardcore than I am.
There's something about like when Sabrina Sutherland she talked about the biggest barrier to getting it through Showtime was that they're making an 8-hour movie, not like a part series. So I think there's times where it's like every now and then I'm like, oh, you know, how is this view when you watch it as a movie? And it's so strange that that scene of like all of them returning to Jack Rabbit's palace was the thing that just tortured me for days. Like where I was like, oh, why is it
That's
like
awesome.
this?
If I had to stay anywhere for 18 hours, it would certainly be in Twin Peaks. So that is probably on the list of things to do. And I want to do it when there's a blizzard. And I would like to add that I am really building myself up to just having my annual rewatch when it starts to get cold out. And I'm just looking forward to it. I know it's going to happen, but I don't have time for it right now, but it's going to happen. All 56 hours or whatever. It's like 70 hours. I know this. You know I know this. I have the actual hour amount of or total hours of the whole show, including the movie and the missing pieces. We're kind of sick that we do this, aren't we, Colin?
Oh no, it's because actually I should mention is that the reason why I did watch the Xanthar movie because I was actually snowed in. Where I live, there was a massive dump of snow, and I was just I didn't have the will to just shovel at all that day. I was like, you know what, I might as well just watch it all in one go. And one of my friends, he actually posted a comment when I announced it on my social media. He's like, didn't you do that 2 years ago and vowed you would never do it again? But I think that comment got more engagement than the actual post that I had. So I thought that was actually really funny. The reason why I bring that up is that there's a scene with Deputy Holcomb when Frank's at the sheriff's station that's very jarring to me because I know we mentioned the scene earlier, but there's that scene where Bobby, when he's at the Double R Diner and the stray bullet goes through, Deputy Holcomb is there and you know he's doing everything he can to hold down the fort under at the behest of Bobby. But then the very next scene is Frank, you know, he's in the office and then he hears a knock on the door. And it's Deputy Holcomb, and he's like, "Hey, do you want to check out my new car?" It's like, "Jesse, I'm very busy, but you know, we'll see you later on tomorrow." And it's just there's just something about that jarring nature of Deputy Holcomb or Jesse Holcomb, if you want me to go by his full name, that he's like in this like chaotic environment, and then suddenly the very next scene, he's very relaxed and you know is going out of his way to ask Frank Truman if he wants to see his car. Is this something that I'm kind of looking a little too far into? Do you think that they were just kind of editing it to have it flow as best as possible? Or do you think there's something about realities or a sense of time that's off?
Well, I do think, first off, that there probably is some questionable editing in terms of the sequence. And I think we're being asked as fans to take a leap on why certain people would be in certain places at certain times. And it is a leap for the creators of the show to say, hey, well, not everything is going to happen in the right order, because I think it feels like they're giving themselves a pass. However, I forgive all that. And I just accept that. You know, whatever is happening at that particular time is what we're meant to be seeing. That all said, I think Jesse is another interesting character that I would have liked to have seen more of. He's a little quirky. He's funny. The scenes that he's in, he made me laugh. So just the way he kind of like stopped, made eye contact, made a facial expression, and then slowly issued his observation about the guy in the parking lot, and you know, then of course about his new car. I think that Frank is probably a father figure to him as well. I think you can pretty much assume that Frank is fatherly to most everybody.
One scene I love with Frank is when he goes to the Great Northern to tell Ben Horn about like Richard Horn killing the little boy and assaulting Miriam. I love Richard Beamer and Robert Forster together in this scene because there's a lot about that we know about Ben Horn from the original series where a lot of that seems to have dissipated, and like any bad blood that could have been there has like long passed like Frank and Ben. And of course, you know, this is the scene where Ben hands off the room 315 key to Frank to give to Harry. But before we get to any, you know, divulge too much further in that key, what were your thoughts on the scene?
It was touching. And to your point, they've probably had some disagreements over the years, but at the end of the day, they are both more vulnerable men and they're older. And I think that there's a mutual respect and appreciation for that, that they don't need to explicitly state at this point. You know, they both have suffered and, you know, they both lost people in one way or another. So I thought it was a very good performance by Beamer and Frank. Again, just that he's the grounded person and he's there for Ben Horn now too.
I don't know why, but the line I like the most out of the two of them, certainly from Robert Forster, it's actually when he leaves. It's like it was good seeing you again, Ben. I wish it was under better circumstances, where he has that very good balance of being professional and personal. And there's just something very heartfelt about the way that Robert Forster delivers that line that sticks out to me.
Definitely. Thanks for observing that. Yeah, thanks for highlighting that. I want to highlight too, just in his credit history, that Bob Fort Robert. I don't know if I'm familiar enough to call him Bob. He probably did go by Bob. I'm a Robert and I go by Rob. But Robert Forster played a cop a whole bunch of times in his career since like the 1960s, and so did Michael Ottke. He played a cop less times than Forster. But nevertheless, they both have that in common. So they've been around a long time, and I wouldn't be surprised if Richard Beamer and Robert Forster knew each other. These are all just actors that I know, like in my house, Richard Beamer and Michael Ottke were kind of household names because of the roles that they played. And this was before Twin Peaks. My mom, you know, was familiar with some of their movies, and of course, West Side Story. That I think these actors were hired because they're kind of like sources of comfort to us because we know them and we can have these familiar faces. Michael Ottke was probably the most well-known person aside from maybe Piper Laurie. I don't know. I think he was probably the most well-known person though when the show first started. It would have been kind of nice for Harry to do that scene though, if Ottke could have been there. So it would have kind of closed the loop between the bad blood that he had with the horns from season two.
Now that Frank does have the key, he does hold on to it during the events that we were talking about, because I'm admittedly forgetting offhand what part it is he has this conversation with Ben Horn. But the fact that he does hold on to the key, and like you mentioned earlier, he does reach out to Goran Cole to talk about like Laura's secret diary. But you know, we get to part 17, and what I always found very interesting is that when Mr. C finds himself outside the sheriff's station, Andy and Lucy are just overjoyed to see him. Like, they just think he's the real Cooper. But Frank, very intuitively, he just knows something is wrong. And I just love how it's like when he goes to Frank's office, there's that part where Frank, he looks at Cooper, long pause, he says, Cooper. And then Mr. C raises hands like in the flesh. I was like, ooh, like that scene gets creepier every time I watch it. And I think there's something to be said that Frank, I think he knows that he's in the presence of something, maybe not to the magnitude of malevolence that he'll ultimately see, but I think he does know that there's something wrong with this Cooper.
I think you're right. And he probably heard about Cooper quite a lot from Harry because Harry loved Cooper. So this was not right.
And actually, another part during this confrontation, for whatever reason, I didn't really think of just how confounding the scene was until I rewatched it. Or not even rewatch it, just been thinking about it. But it's the scene where Mr. C, he pulls the gun out. You see like Frank's hat fly up. There's like a
I
little
love that.
flash, no damage, but then that's when Lucy kills Mr. C. And she has that realization, like, I get how phones work now, which is a really endearing way to like have to give her like a bit of a send-off of sorts, like that one grandiose moment. But the hat, for years I knew about this scene, but I never thought about the hat. I love to always be prepared and feel like I have answers, but I don't like to lie to people. The hat confounds me more and more the more I thought about, writing down for this episode. Did you have any thoughts on this whole debacle?
I just love the sight of it. It's so funny. Just the hat rising up like a cartoon character. And we have Lucy to thank for that. We have to assume that because she shot Bad Cooper just in time, that his gun pointed upward and caused his hat to do that somehow. But yeah, just the way it just goes up and down really quick is really amusing.
And this is the next part, and this is why I mentioned why Frank didn't quite understand the magnitude of what Mr. C was, because this is when the whole office starts to dim, and then you get the dirty bearded men who are just like covering him with blood again, and just like and Dell Cooper, like the quote unquote real Dell Cooper, is like don't touch that body, and Frank knows better than to just let them do their thing, but. This, I mean, Millie, this is where it just stops being about Frank and just about like this whole part in part 17. What were your thoughts about like any of this?
That the regular people who were there must be like, what the hell is it's just really that was there for us to bring everybody together and have these legacy characters there happening again with one of the most perplexing and interesting parts from part eight, where these dirty bearded men show up and you get the like the snarling and evil smile of Bob emerging from the belly. And just to that, I hear Mrs. Palmer saying, "That face, there it is right there for all of them to see." It's really exciting. Seeing it for the first time was very exciting because after all these years, and then more recently, after all these parts, this scene of high consequences happening now. And I think that there were a lot of people in the room, and we even Lynch couldn't give us the space to think about what they're all thinking. I mean, we just have to assume that they're all saying the same thing he did. What the hell?
The one thing that I think is interesting that Frank does, I mean, he's the only one that has it, so he has to give it to Cooper, but he's the one that hands off the room 315 key to Cooper. Yeah, this is more about the key than anything else, but I always found it interesting is that the front key looks how you'd expect it, but then the back says clean place, reasonably priced. I forget if they explicitly show in part 17, but I think it's in part 4 when Jade, when she's cleaning out her car. And the guy gives her the key, and you see explicitly says clean place, reasonably priced. Do you have any thoughts about the key? And of course, like I said, in the case of Frank, he wouldn't know any more about it, but there's something about the key that I'm just fascinated by.
Of course, I have thoughts about that because it's not what the Great Northern said, or it wasn't in their marketing materials, presumably. It's what Cooper said. That's what I need. It's a reference to what he needs. Clean place, reasonably priced. So that is clearly not real. I think we just have to assume that a lot of these events that happened just weren't real. I hope that's not bursting anybody's bubble, but for that to be on the keychain just is absurd. But maybe it's meant for us, just to say, oh, yeah.
For me, the key, it's like what I was saying before about the three realities, about there's that third one where Cooper is imposing his reality on others through a dream.
Yeah, that's a
And
good
I
point.
think that's why, because he has this key on him, when he's like in the Red Room for 25 plus years. So I think there's just something about how it's sort of what I was saying about Laura and Fire Walk Me, how she views the world. The return in a lot of cases is how Cooper views the world. I would say it's a detriment to people, but that's my main takeaway from the key.
Maybe it's a nod to the perspective of he wants to remember things as he likes to remember them, not necessarily how they happened. And we are, I think, pretty much explicitly told in part 17 that we were seeing this through Cooper's eyes.
Oh yeah, because that's I think when he hands the key off, that is when Cooper is that Cooper, the face that's superimposed, is over at that point. So I think for me, that's why it just kind of adds on my end. But the last thing that I have is actually not in part 17, but it's in the final dossier. Admittedly, Frank isn't explicitly mentioned, but Tammy, she starts talking about how in that final segment of the final dossier, about how she finds out that Laura wasn't killed, but she has disappeared. And she does say that she does go around asking at the sheriff's station, but I have a hard time believing she wouldn't ask Hawk or Frank Truman just because they're so high up. And she does refer to it as like how everyone is clueless. Did you have any thoughts about this part in the final dossier or Frank's role in it?
I wasn't as much of a fan of the final dossier, Colin. I think that the secret history was a lot of fun, and I really enjoy that ride. And whenever I read it or listen to it, because after I read it, which you must read it so you can enjoy all the pictures and all the love that went into constructing that, you know, then I bought the audio version so that I could also hear it being acted out. Anyway, back to the final dossier. I didn't really give that too much thought. I think that it's meant to try to leave things mysterious. And that's kind of like a vehicle that Frost employed by using that fugue state, if you will, that he was kind of imposing on everybody towards the end of the book. And I do feel that that book was a bit more manipulative in terms of like how we're supposed to receive it, like so that he could just claim a lot of things and it didn't necessarily have to be real because people's memories were clearly shoddy or, and it's fine. I still enjoyed it and I've reread that too. And I also listened, of course, to the audiobook for that. I don't mean to speak too negatively about that experience. It just really wasn't as good as the Secret History.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, I've had people on the show and actually also off the show where they shared similar enough sentiments. I have my conditional statements of the final dossier. That I'm actually going to save more so when I get to a Tammy episode. But I think for me, when I look at the final dossier, I look at it as like none of this is objective. It's like kind of going through Tammy's perspective. So even when she mentions something, I think like you kind of have to challenge the veracity, even with her ranking in the FBI. But that for me, it's like putting aside my conditional statements for the final dossier, I do look at this as being like one of the big indicators of like the multiple realities. And I know that not all fans subscribe to that, but I just think that to kind of come back to Frank in particular, the fact that him and Hawk are, or the people at the sheriff station are clueless, it does kind of line up with that scene in Part 14 when they find themselves back at Jack Rabbit's Palace, where Hawk and Frank, they're very intuitive people, but there's certain things that they can't retain. And that's something I always found very interesting throughout the return. Like, for example, Hawk, in I believe it's Part 2, when he goes to Glastonbury Grove, and you see the Black Lodge curtains just emerge for a moment and go away, and he sees it and he reacts, but he never follows up on it. Yeah, like I said, Frank and Hawk, they're extraordinarily intelligent. There's a reason why they went to Jack Rabbit's Palace to begin with, but I think it's just like these random bursts of like where their intuitiveness just kind of flatlines that I found interesting.
That is disappointing that they didn't do more with Hawk in that regard.
If I had to guess, I mentioned this when I did my Margaret Lanterman episode, but I honestly believe that if Hawk, or actually better, if Katherine Coulson, if she was alive to film all of the return, I think she would have been alongside with Hawk, and there probably would have been something more tangible with like their interactions in particular.
I think you're right. I think that there would have been more for more interaction with Hawk and possibly with other people. Maybe even Mrs. Palmer, you know, Mrs. Palmer really needed somebody, that's for sure.
But yeah, I think that winds down the conversation of Frank Truman. Did you have any final thoughts before we ended the episode?
I want to thank you for including me in your show. I'm really impressed by your thoughtful observations in your episodes, and a lot of your guests are very thoughtful as well. And it makes watching and experiencing Twin Peaks that much more fun. And so yeah, I just really appreciate that you created this and that you're doing so well with it. And you've had a lot of exciting things happen already. So great job. And yeah, just happy to know you. And Twin Peaks just is the gift that keeps on giving. So you know, now you're part of that. So really appreciate you having me on, Colin.
I certainly appreciate having on, but wow, those are like that is extraordinarily kind. And I know that I mentioned it like before the podcast, but I knew that you'd be a really great fit for this because of how you articulate your observations, how conversational you are. So I'm just as honored that you agreed to be on it personally.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I really was tantalized by the idea of doing it. I wouldn't have expected to get an opportunity like this. But I'm really glad that you asked me. And also, I think we have to acknowledge Robert Forster's contribution to entertainment and to Twin Peaks. He did pass away just what it was in 2022. I'm sorry.
2019. It was
Oh,
actually the same week El Camino came out, I believe.
that's
I
right.
so
That's
it
right.
was really like
I can't
his
believe it's been
first.
that long.
Yeah,
Wow.
it doesn't feel
Yeah.
like it was 4 years, but
We got to
unfortunately it
point out,
has.
he was in Breaking Bad, and he also played a mysterious character, and he was in Jackie Brown, which he got an Academy Award nomination for, because he was one of the best things about it, and it also revived his career. Which, oh, by the way, Lynch used a lot of Quentin Tarantino people for the return. I think that's an interesting observation, but. Yeah, thanks for correcting the record on when he passed away. But I would like to leave it where, just acknowledging what a great actor he was. And I appreciate being asked to talk about Frank Truman because I really like Robert Forster. And also, as I mentioned, I am in the military and I've worked alongside many people who are like him, who've been through a lot of things. And if I had to pick a character, then he would be one that I would feel honored to talk about because he represents strength and compassion, and also, he's a substantive thinker, and I think that we need more critical thinkers. And he's just a good person, and he's a servant of the community that he loves. So it really is an honor to honor Robert Forster and to talk about our favorite show together with you. And yeah, I'm just wishing you all the best. I'm gonna keep listening to it. Together.